Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Victoria Sperry about her book that's just come out from Manchester University Press, titled Shakespeare's Adolescence: Age, Gender, and the Body in Shakespearean Performance and Early Modern Culture, which is a really interesting look at Shakespeare. Because actually, if we stop and think about it, which I admit I had not done until I had read this book, there's a whole bunch of adolescence in Shakespeare's plays. What did that actually mean in the early modern period? How were audiences thinking of this stage of life? How was Shakespeare portraying it? There's actually rather a lot to get into here. So Vicky, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Miranda. I'm really pleased that you've invited me to be here, so thank you.
Well, I'm very pleased that you said yes. And I think to start us off, could you please introduce yourself a little bit to our audience and explain why you decided to write this book?
I'm Vicky Sperry. I'm senior lecturer specialising in early modern literature, and I work in the English and Creative Writing Department at the University of Exeter. And I suppose the starting point for this book, what got me sort of hooked a little bit, actually comes down to the twins in Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, because this book actually really comes out of research I was doing for another project. I think that's probably quite common with your interviewees, Miranda, but I was actually looking at reproductive theories and how sort of medical ideas in the early modern period fed into ideas of identity formation. And so I was really intrigued with that idea of, in Twelfth Night, there are different sex twinned characters who are mistaken for each other. So it seemed like a really interesting way of thinking about twins from the point of reproduction and that point of origin that's shared in the womb. But what I found when looking at Twelfth Night was that in exploring how and why Shakespeare's same-sex twins are confused for each other, is that I found that I actually needed to extend my research from thinking about ideas of, say, conception and childbirth and what was happening in the womb, to grappling with other issues around later stages in the life cycle, because they were clearly also, and actually more pressingly important, it seemed, in relation to the gender identity, particularly for these twins who are quite notoriously mistaken for each other. And Twelfth Night is so important to me because it's really a play that scholars of Shakespeare talk about a lot in relation to gender fluidity with this cross-dressing narrative. But time again, I kept seeing that this issue of age, that these twins are surprisingly young, like really young compared to a lot of other cross-dressed characters, didn't seem to crop up in that scholarship. So in that way, I realized that that's something that I wanted to really dig into and tease out. And when I looked across, as you said in your introduction, very kindly said in the introduction, when I started to think about that across Shakespeare's plays, I realized just how central adolescence really is to his plays. And also that I kept picking up on these signs of puberty and maturation that I thought, actually, there's something really quite interesting here. And so it began with the twins of Twelfth Night, and it sort of expanded from there.
That does make rather a lot of sense as a starting point. As you said, it's not surprising to have something grow out of a previous project. And the twins really do come up a lot in Shakespeare. So yeah, that makes sense as a beginning. I do want to kind of, before we get into what you found in this investigation, I want to talk a bit about how you went about it. Because obviously thinking about things like age, gender, combining those, there's a lot of different ways that you could pursue that sort of investigation. So can you tell us a bit about how you approach the analysis of these aspects in the book and how you decided on this?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the book is as you say, about age, but it's also about gender. I'm not trying to sort of, you know, having sort of grappled with Twelfth Night, as you say, and I do so quite a lot in the book. Gender was sort of my starting point in a way. But what I realised was that these nuances I was observing in Shakespeare's characters, and indeed what I was finding in the medical literature that I was looking at, I really saw a need to be putting age first ahead of gender in my thinking. And that was because I particularly wanted to allow space to draw out where there was sameness and symmetry at work in constructions of adolescence for boys and girls. So I wanted to begin with age and that idea of symmetry, but I then wanted to see and evaluate where gender comes in and how it may or may not be the most pressing concern in certain constructions of those adolescent identities. So it's sort of a subtle shift that I was working on there. And in putting age first, and this is something I do deal with at length in the introduction to the book, I also wanted to quite pointedly reevaluate some of the assumptions that have really been key to considering gendered bodies in early modern culture, and particularly in early modern theatrical culture, because there have been several really influential and still really important, and you know, studies about gender that have shaped our understanding of Shakespeare's characters and theatrical practices. And in particular, it's the idea that adolescent boys would have performed the parts of females in Shakespeare's company. And that sort of really understandably captured the imagination of lots of critics. And so there's a wealth of scholarship around this sort of gender identity and gender performance in Shakespeare's plays. And some of those have actually used early modern medicine in figuring out what's going on. But again, age is often either sidelined or possibly even sort of overlooked entirely in some of those models. So when it comes to sort of figuring out what I was doing, one of the most influential theories that I had to spend some time unpacking in the book is Thomas Le Cur's identification of what's called the one sex model for the period. And this is where I'm not quite sure sort of how far listeners might know that theory really well. So the one sex model from Thomas Le Cur, which he looked into and he published work around in the early 1990s. In that model, Le Cur was interested in something that I'm really interested in the book, and that's recognising that early modern bodies are understood and related to ideas of humoral heat. Like, humoral heat is absolutely integral to how early modern individuals understood themselves in relation to their health and well-being, but also in relation to their character and personalities. It's really key to everything that goes on. And Le Cur was particularly interested in gender, and he observed that men are often described as humorally hot, while women are described more typically as humorally cold. So Le Cur set up this one sex model and observed how at one end of the spectrum, you often see a men, and I would say implicitly adult men, are identified as humorally hot, and perfect is a word that you often get. And at the other less perfect, imperfect end of the gender model for humoral heat, Le Cur put women as imperfect. And there's reason for him doing that. You do get aspects around humoral heat that set men and women in opposition to each other. And so this one sex model had a sliding scale of heat that differentiated between men and women in terms of sort of that spectrum. And that model has been so influential in early modern studies, and particularly theatre studies. And we can see how it's a misogynistic model that puts women as less perfect than men. But its scope for that sense of gender fluidity, where heated behaviour in women might move them fluidly towards masculine and then towards masculine behaviour and manhood, and behaviour seen as cool in men might see them slide down the spectrum and be feminised, was something that really piqued critical interest in the 1990s, and it's persisted in works for much longer than that. And actually, it's quite interesting because that legacy in Shakespeare studies is particularly apparent, even though there's been a lot of sort of work from medical historians that has challenged Lecoeur's model and said actually it's not the whole picture, there's more that needs to be done. And one key critic to mention is Helen King there, who's actually written a book that's called The One Sex Model on Trial. So the one sex model is really fascinating and part of the picture, but it's also something that's slightly skewed our understanding of what might be going on when we see gender fluidity in Shakespeare's works, because it doesn't really take account of age. It sets men and women implicitly as adults at the end of the spectrum. And the thing that my methodology, apologies, this is quite a lengthy answer, but hopefully one that's necessary to understand what I'm doing with age and gender, is that in my book, I stress that actually this idea of humoral heat that's at the heart of ideas about early modern bodies is absolutely central to ideas about age. And when it comes to an adolescent age, both girls and boys were seen to be undergoing changes in the body that was down to puberty that was underscored as being excessively heated. So adolescent girls and boys at the age of adolescence were seen to be the most hot, if you like, as they would ever be in their life cycle. And that basic notion already of being an adolescent girl or an adolescent boy who's extremely hot, and that's quite a common idea that you see everywhere in early modern writings, already problematizes that one sex model, because an adolescent superheated male is going to be hotter than that perfected adult male at one end of the spectrum and either fall off the end or supersede the adult in ways that sort of is problematic in all sorts of ways with how adult authority and perfection was framed in relation to childhood. And where the adolescent girl becomes extremely heated and moves away from that coolness assumed for womanhood and becomes sort of strangely masculinized and creeping up the scale towards manhood, when actually what we find is that puberty and the changes in that heat around girlhood is more commonly linked to ideas of emergent womanhood rather than becoming masculine. So to sum up, after sort of going through sort of where that all fits in terms of age and gender and humoral heat, in the book I'm attending to how and why humoral heat is absolutely central to understanding ideas of an adolescent age and those changes of puberty, and how in putting boys and girls together, that helps us understand what's going on in terms of age-specific sameness, as well as differentiations that seem to be down to gendered ideas. So I hope that sort of summarises at some length what my approach is.
No, that's very helpful. And I think it raises a whole, it kind of takes us right back into that context of how people were thinking about this then, which is obviously very helpful for us to understand as we go farther through the book. And it's in fact that last point about kind of putting girls and boys together, but then also still being aware of the differences that I'd like to pick up next. To what extent then, if we are looking at this specific age category, as you've clearly identified we need to, were there gender differences within that? Was puberty seen as being sort of something that was different for boys versus girls, men versus women? Or was it kind of like, no, there is this weird stage where they're all super hot and then they sort of differentiate out as they sort of calm down a bit. But while they're in this stage, they're actually more similar than different. Or are there still differences within the age stage?
Right. Yeah. So There's aspects of both, actually, and that's something that I try to sort of draw out in the book, where there are similarities and there's scope for sort of particularly navigations of the more gendered, restrictive models that you get for adolescents. But primarily, I would say that experience of puberty were largely constructed as gender specific in early modern culture. Part of the reason the twins in Twelfth Night seem so young is that even by the end of the play, they're considered exactly the same as if they haven't started puberty, where they would have signs, which I expect we'll touch on as we continue to talk, those signs of sort of gendered maturity that would differentiate, that you would expect to differentiate between Sebastian, the male twin, and Viola, the female twin in that play. And puberty for me is so interesting in that way. And how you talked about heat, I thought was really great, actually, Miranda. So sort of really sort of got to the crux of the issue, is puberty seems to be when gender becomes more insistent in early modern life cycle modelling, which is why I think it's such an interesting age, because male and female were sort of set together in a way in that they were both understood to be undergoing a state of transformation. Their bodies are in motion, in a process of heading towards becoming men and women. And there's this shared humoral characteristic of increasing humoral heat. And that does seem similarities across the sexes in terms of the changes that are being noted in terms of cognitive development and this insistence upon change and quite dynamic change. Heat leads to an energized physicality for both sexes. But as girls and boys are heading towards those adult identities, we also see that there's keeping that in sight. And that means sort of keeping in sight identities that do become more clearly bound to ideas of particularly reproductive features of the body. And those are quite heavily gendered in early modern cultural thinking. So, for example, some key differences that I look at include that early modern writers commonly observe, for example, that puberty in boys and the heat that goes with that leads to boys beginning to grow facial hair. And that's imagined as a kind of overspilling of bodily heat and indeed moisture. Moisture is part of the question, of the calculation as well, but it's emanating this heat and moisture from the developing hot seed of the male. And described by, I think there's a great description from Thomas Eliot in his book, The Castle of Health, where he describes body hair as an excrement of the body, this kind of exceeding the boundaries because it's this excess of heat and moisture. But in girls of the same age, and interestingly, there is a paralleling of beard growth in boys, and in girls of around the same age of about 14, girls are specifically said, and women sort of as a continuation of that, not to grow beards, but precisely because the humoral logic takes a slightly different turn, because girls are imagined as being really heated, but not quite as heated as boys. And the understanding was that then led to a different sign of their maturation and a redirection of that excess heat and that moisture. And that was through the onset of menstruation. So it's a really interesting connection and parallel that you see made by writers that do sort of set something quite distinctly different if you think of a bodily manifestation of puberty, which is beard growth and menstruation, are set regularly together. So there's sort of this sameness aspect going on. But at the same time, there is also that manifestation of puberty as a sign on the body is decidedly gendered in that boys grow beards and girls begin to menstruate. And the gendering of pubescent bodies goes further because we see that there are particular biases at play. And I would say that you see writers spend a lot more time scrutinising with a degree of intensity the maturation of female bodies. So while boys and girls both undergo changes that result from this increase of heat, heat-fueled actions and changes in girls are more readily conflated with that sense of the adult woman they're about to become. And that leads to concerns about threatened chastity. So that concerns about securing what would be perceived as an acceptable, modest adult sexuality starts to intrude, I think, upon constructions of girlhood and adolescence more than you see it doing so for boys, although it is still part of the picture. So one thing that I'll highlight for girls in terms of those gendered signs of puberty is the condition called green sickness. And green sickness was a disease that by Shakespeare's time had become associated with female puberty in particular and menstrual disorders. So a girl could be, in a way that a boy couldn't, a girl could be thought to be subject to disorderly menstruation that would result in green sickness, where a girl's behaviour, her mood, and often her self-assertiveness could be seen to sanction, be a symptom of green sickness and sanction medical intervention with various remedies, but also family interventions such as hasty marriages, because green sickness was seen to lead to sort of all sorts of corruption of menstrual blood, but also disorderly desires. And there were fears that green sick girls might lose their reputations and go and have illicit sex outside of marriage. And scholars like Ursula Potter and Helen King have really shown how green sickness for girls meant that puberty threatened being diagnosed as sick more readily. Although I would say that what's fascinating and something I spend sort of much of the book doing is that while there are these gender biases, and it's really apparent in a condition like green sickness, is that Shakespeare's plays do also include outgoing girl characters who seem to navigate those hostile restrictions based on gender. And we're often on the side of those adolescent girls. So there are ways in which sort of, you know, plots and settings allow for explorations of girls to be kind of heated in adolescence in ways that can have positive formulations as well. But it is clear that there is a gendering going on, as well as this sort of similarity. And it's usually in the similarities that I see this scope for expansive possibilities, and where the gender restrictions come in, that's where you see limitations on girls more so than boys.
Mm. That's a really interesting result of doing this compare and contrast. Mm. And I'd actually like to ask you about a particular aspect of this that, I mean, I'm the one obviously asking the question, so I get some amount of dictatorial license here in terms of which details I ask you further about. Okay. But something that really struck me was that you show examples in the book of kind of the ways in which adolescence is being talked about and discussed. And a thing that seemed to kind of keep happening is the idea that adolescence was being described as ripening, flowering, blooming, and then like in the same sentence or in the same line, death, decay, decrepit. Like these things were really close together, and it almost seemed to be kind of, if you got one, you immediately got the other, which, you know, is not immediately what I would think of when thinking about kind of adolescence and what happens. So why do we see these terms so close together? And does this fit more in terms of the kind of what you're telling us about how they are talked about similarly across genders? Or does this fall into more the category of women get more of this attention?
Right. So, yes, it's really interesting. And early modern life cycles tend to be talked about in this really, you know, evocative horticultural or agricultural language of flowering, as you said, and ripening, and usually it's adulthood where you're not seen as, you know, quite too old. It's quite ageist in its framing of being too old and decaying, seems to be the language, and rotting. Adulthood is sort of in its prime, as it's sometimes described, would be the ripe stage. So adolescence is repeatedly this ripening stage. So it should be quite distanced, really, from rotting and decay. And one of my favourite, more positive images that you get is from Henry Cuff's Different Ages of Man. And I quote it quite a lot in the book, partly because I really love the image, which in 1607, he describes adolescence as the budding and blossoming age. And that sort of initially seems to be that really promising state that anticipates ripeness, and there's sort of a reproductive center there that is that fruitfulness, bearing, being able to bear children comes from this process of flowering, you know, as you would see on trees and fruit trees and that kind of thing. But yes, as you say, repeatedly in early modern culture, that's not sort of simply how we see it. And decay intrudes upon images of adolescence. And it is for both boys and girls that happens. As You Like It is Shakespeare's play that notoriously is interested in the human life cycle. I mean, many of his plays are, but it's As You Like It that has the Seven Ages of Man speech, the All the World's a Stage speech. And it's also a play that says quite explicitly that there's a line that says, from hour to hour, we ripen ripe, and then from hour to hour, we rot and rot. So there sort of seems to be this missing out of being ripe and in a state of adulthood where you can sort of be a bit sort of, you know, there's not too much change going on. It simply is this idea that you're going to ripen and be adolescent and then you're going to start rotting, which is odd. As you say, it's slightly jarring, but it's really common. And that can be positively framed. As You Like It includes a really elderly character called Adam, who partners on stage the adolescent male character of Orlando for the beginning part of the play. And that seems to be quite a positive way of putting older age with a younger age in a kind of cause and effect way that's kind of positive and suggesting that if you behave in an admirable way, Orlando is seen as this really positive figure of adolescence, then you can anticipate having a long life. Adam is in his 80s and he describes himself as having a lusty winter. So you have this agricultural language, which also often fits with the seasons as well. And so that can actually be quite positive, but it can also be, and probably more readily in the ones that I think are more striking in the book, the idea that juxtaposing adolescence flowering, blooming with decay and older age is that it offers quite a cautionary image as well, that how adolescence is handled can be either enabling promise and all this beautiful potential of a flower to be realised, but it can also lead to premature ageing and that what these hyperheated adolescents might do can lead to damage to their bodies and perhaps sort of harming their ageing process. And so that agricultural motif really then lends itself, and it starts to seem quite appropriate actually that the flower is beautiful and has all these sort of valued characteristics, and it's also vulnerable and potentially fragile and something that either needs to be protected or guided and in certain ways. You asked whether boys and girls get treated similarly or differently. Well, initially there sort of is some similarity in that boys can be seen to damage their flowering adolescence. Detrimental repercussions are seen to particularly be linked to sort of ill-advised sexual exploits. So there's some fears around debilitating the reproductivity of their, you know, the efficacy of their seed. If they're having sex too often and too early, that they may not be able to father children in adulthood. But also more figuratively, you get quite a lot of sort of educational writings around boys describing them as flowers. And one that I remember is Henry Peacham's description when he's talking about boys going into educational setups, thinking of university as a garden full of flowers. And he describes the threat of flowering adolescents becoming rank, partly because they allow other individuals to taint them. So sort of ideas of sort of avoiding negative influences can be seen to lead to decay. However, and this is a bit of a trend, we see that there is a gendering that emphasizes things for girls more so than boys. Boys might be wayward and make ill-advised decisions that can sort of hamper and sort of their flowering state, but they tend to be down to the boys' sort of own decisions, poor choices, and there always seems to be the possibility that a boy might be welcomed back as a prodigal son who can steady himself in time for adulthood. But girls and that idea of corrupted flowers that fester become particularly graphic for girls and more intimately connected with girls' bodies than it does for boys. And that's partly because menstruation itself was often called a girl's flowers at this, and also a woman's flowers. It does carry on into older age, but often seems to be sort of linked to the idea that menstruation begins with puberty. And so that idea of festering tainted flowers being situated within a girl's body, particularly linking back to that idea of green sickness, meant that there was something different going on, I think, around how boys and girls could navigate that threat of decline and contagion, whether through sort of, you know, better choices, but there's sort of a more insistent framing of girls being vulnerable, and that their bodies themselves might betray them and lead to that kind of decay and decline. So yes, it's throughout modern culture and motifs of adolescence that make this pairing, but there are some intricacies around how that gendering works again.
Okay, so we now have, I think, a pretty good understanding of what the discourse was at the time around these issues, the extent to which it differed between genders. How did this show up then in Shakespeare's characters and characterizations? If we sort of put ourselves in the audience of the time, how would he show this? For example, if we go back to what you were saying earlier about faces, mm-hmm. how would the characterizations of some of Shakespeare's teenage characters, I mean, what would maybe an audience expect to see or see on stage in terms of the faces of the characters, in terms of the voices of the characters? Like, how would all these ideas actually show up in a play?
Right, yeah. So they're quite easy. It seems that actually once you start looking for what these signs are, that they seem to be quite manageable in many ways. So that heat that's rising from the reproductive seed that's developing in both boys and girls led to some quite sort of clear manifestations on their faces in particular. So boys would be seen to be beginning to grow facial hair. And that's quite an interesting sort of distinction, that beginning, that sort of idea of a beard that is in the process of growing can be represented on stage. So, for example, some scholarship has looked at the significance of beards for underpinning masculine identities in early modern culture, and that's absolutely the case, but tends to be about full beards and sort of the idea that there's a clear distinction between lacking a beard and being not yet fully masculine in terms of adulthood and having a beard. But actually what we also see going on in Shakespeare is a little bit more subtlety in placing sort of degrees of maturation through faces. So for example, Orlando, who I've already mentioned in As You Like It, is quite incessantly described as having a small beard. So there's some facial hair, and he was probably played by the adult actor Richard Burbage. So it suggests that probably Burbage had his face partially shaven. So that the characters around him can say, oh, you've got a small beard. And in fact, Rosalind is sort of the courted lady, the girl, actually an adolescent girl who is being courted in the play. And she cross-dresses as Ganymede. So she cross-dresses as a boy adolescent. Now, Orlando is himself an adolescent, but there seems to be in that play a really interesting kind of representation of degrees of growth in terms of adolescence, because you have a beard-free figure who is Ganymede, the cross-dressed Rosalind, opposite Burbage as Orlando with a tiny beard. And there's sort of this reference to sort of this older adolescent opposite a younger persona of male adolescence, which can also at the same time allow for us to see the female adolescent of Rosalind. And the way that that becomes manifested, female adolescence, seems to be, again, about heated faces. So the heat is rising from a girl's reproductive seed, just like it is from the male, even though more of that heat and moisture is being expelled through the onset of menstruation. But that residual heat on the face is often associated in early modern theatre and culture more broadly for girls and puberty is blushing. So you can use makeup in that instance, as was applied to boy actors' faces to signal that they are performing a female role. We know that the white makeup was applied to boys' faces and also quite often blushes as well. And so, for example, we get a sense of how old a female character is if there is this allusion to rosy cheeks, and it feeds back into that agricultural, horticultural language. So Isabella in Measure for Measure, for example, becomes quite eroticized by the male characters around her when they start to note her cheek roses, right? So there's rosy cheeks on girls. We have Juliet described in a similar way. And it often links back to this idea of puberty being visible and palpable on stage. In terms of voices, lots of scholars have looked at ideas of breaking voices for adolescent boys when it comes to that theatrical setup. But I tend to focus more on that idea of heated voices that are also responding to that rising heat that leads to heated brains. And so rather than the idea of vocal pitch, which is part of the situation, the heat that rises in adolescence was understood to widen vocal passages and so deepen the pitch of the voice, both in boys and girls, though more significantly again in boys. But that rising heat also led to cognitive agility and verbal dexterity. So in terms of how adolescents sound in Shakespeare's play, they're often speaking wittily, and they're often engaging and compelling in really interesting ways. And sometimes that heat and words can be quite negative. You get bragging youth depicted when Portia's thinking about who she's going to disguise herself as in The Merchant of Venice. But in the end, she rejects that idea of heat being sort of disorderly speech and decides to go for cross-dressing as an adolescent called Balthazar, who is well-scripted in Venetian law and rhetorical skills so that he can hold his own as a persona in the Venetian court. But of course, a cross-dressing narrative in Merchant of Venice suggests not only the skill of that character, that male adolescent character that Portia's performing, but also Portia herself. And Portia is probably also a female adolescent at the upper end of the age spectrum, based on various signs we have in the play and her pairing with Bassanio. She's probably not yet 25, which is the end age that most early modern commentators had for adolescents. So we get this sort of sense of things you can see in sort of growing beards and blushes, and things that you hear to help signal that these are adolescent characters in Shakespeare's plays.
Very helpful to kind of put all of those ideas about what this stage looks like and understand kind of concretely where we might see that in Shakespeare. Another thing that we might see that you talk about in the book, beyond sort of faces and voices, is body size. Can you tell us a little bit about what this would look like, and maybe particularly how this gives us a new way of seeing nuance in A Midsummer Night's Dream?
Yes. This is based on one of the chapters that was sort of quite, I found quite compelling actually, because it involved a bit of rethinking of how adolescent actors, their characters that they play, are thought about in that early modern setup. Because quite often when thinking about adolescents as children, you get this contrast and this binary setup between the adults in Shakespeare's company and on the stage and the children in the company. And in terms of body size, that often encourages a sense of the very small, sort of this idea of this sort of the static image of a very small child opposite this looming adult figure, both in the theatre company and in the scenes of the play. And there is scope to think about it. With Midsummer Night's Dream, there clearly are issues around intergenerational relationships, because the character of Hermia is disobeying her father and also the ruler of Athens in pursuing her chosen lover, who is Lysander in the plot. But while that adult-child opposition is important and is something that I grapple with in the book, the thing that becomes clear, and hopefully sort of even as we've already been speaking about adolescence in early modern cultural framing, is that that stage of life was primarily understood in terms of change and notable growth. So that idea of sort of an idea of a sort of static small child set in opposition to a looming adult didn't really fully appreciate, I thought, that motion of adolescence that was so insistent as in early modern constructions as growing. And when framed as growing and having dynamic physicalities, again underpinned by that working of humoral heat, we start to see that actually quite a lot in Midsummer Night's Dream, for example, utterly hinges on ideas about adolescence and signals the importance of the interaction between adolescent characters in that play. And that's sort of something that was sort of really notable for me, is that these adolescents were set alongside each other far more often than they were in opposition to adult figures in the play. So the two key characters I think about are girl characters of Helena and Hermia, who we hear have grown up together in the play. And there's a lovely image from Helena of them being two lovely berries who have grown on the same branch. So there's sort of a paralleling of these girls who have grown up together. And one of the things that the play insistently does is it compares the body size of these two adolescent characters, these girl characters who also would have been played by adolescent boy actors. And in the play, Hermia is characterised as very short compared to the very tall Helena. And we have this confirmed in the insults used about each girl, and that's really telling in how the idea of their age is being used to evaluate their characters. And Lysander has some particularly barbed insults that he uses for Hermia. He emphasises her small stature by calling her a dwarf, a bead, and quite strikingly, he calls her, as an insult, an acorn. And an acorn's not really an insult I'd come across very often, so I was quite intrigued by that. But it makes a lot of sense in relation to ideas about stunted growth, and that he's insulting her by saying that she isn't as physically mature as he would expect, and sort of within that scope of the sort of life cycle of an oak tree in that instance. And by comparison, Helena is described as a maypole, so she's tall, and that signifies that she's like the pole used for May Day celebrations. But a maypole would also have been made from a tree, but a grown tree, far beyond an acorn state. So it's a contrasting companion image to what we hear about Helena. About Hermia, sorry. And so the exchange is really lively in Midsummer Night's Dream and utterly depends on the physicality of the actors as they interact and sort of vie for prominence in that scene. And it's quite heavy on its misogyny as well. Each girl becomes evaluated in terms of her potential as a sexual partner in marriage and going into adulthood, with Hermia insists that Helena is a painted maypole, so it gets caught up with ideas of the painted lady and anti-cosmetic attitudes of the period and the idea that Helena is sexually available, whereas Hermia, being described, as we heard, as an acorn, is associated with dysfunctional fertility. And so she is being degraded in terms of being evaluated in line with ideas of female beauty that link up to fertility. And she is seen not only as an acorn, but also she's likened to a low-growing plant called not grass, that's a weed that is associated with uterine disorders and infertility. So there's these ideas around actually how are these girls being evaluated. But the one thing that I think is going on in setting these girls alongside each other in a play like A Midsummer Night's Dream is that we know that part of the confusions and the hostilities being voiced are down to the use of a magical flower. And so all these judgments in a way make sense because of medical ideas, and there are restrictive gender ideas at work in those medical ideas. But the play actually sort of asks for some debate around that, I think, because it sets those growing adolescent girls together rather than in opposition to adults in ways that asks us to recognise that there's variety and difference in the way in which these girls who have grown together might experience adolescence. And the play also encourages you to sympathise with each girl, so that when each of them pauses to say at different points in the play, why am I not thought beautiful? Why do I not get to have what I want? We're encouraged to root for those girls to do well, so that we're not fully endorsing some of those hostile ideas that we also see at work in the play. So I think there sort of is a sense that by setting the girls together and showing their difference in degree in terms of their physical size, we get a sense of differentiated adolescent characters and actually evaluating of each of those in different ways. So it sort of manages to reject some of those hostile ideas that would be more apparent if we were just thinking about adults in relation children as adolescents.
I always find it so fascinating when you read a book and it's kind of allows you to add a layer of understanding to something. You're like, oh, that's something that audiences at the time probably would have kind of automatically been reading into this, and we had no idea. Now we do. So thank you for taking us through that. I wonder if I can ask you to kind of tell us or talk us through Shakespeare, not in terms of a particular play, but I suppose the group of all of his works together, because of course he's writing over a decent chunk of time. And as with kind of any time and place, what's happening in the popular discourse around these sorts of discussions? You know, what does it mean to be an adolescent? What does it look like to be a good young person or a bad young person? I mean, those are debates we're still having now that change pretty quickly over a few years. So what's happening kind of with Shakespeare? Is he portraying adolescence the same way across his career? Do we see changes in how he's thinking about or showing or discussing adolescence if we think about his works kind of over time?
Yeah, so I would say that Shakespeare seems to be always interested in adolescent characters because they feature across his work. So in that sense, there's a lot that sort of stays the same in this sort of central positioning of adolescent characters. But I do think that there are changes in how adolescence, the subtleties around adolescence come to the fore in some of Shakespeare's plays. And I'm not sure if that's necessarily so down to cultural shifts in what makes a good or a bad adolescent per se, but maybe about the role that theatre itself is contributing to those discussions. And partly because in having written certain roles for adolescents earlier in his career, I think Shakespeare probably returns to and adds complexity to what he's already done. So having just described what's going on with Hermia and Helena in Midsummer Night's Dream, which is from around, so it's quite early, but it's mid sort of 1590s play. By the time he's using sort of comparative height as one of the things to look at there. He's adding extra complexity by the time you get to the end of the 1590s with As You Like It, where he also returns to that sort of trope and has Rosalind opposite Celia. We hear that Rosalind is more than common tall, and so Celia is her short companion in that instance. But Shakespeare then adds to that sort of interaction by also having cross-dressing going on as well, and then thinking about let's have Orlando and different ideas of male and female adolescence going on in that degrees of sort of growth that I talked about in the answer when I was talking about facial hair. So there seems to be sort of aspects of experimentation and revisiting ideas and adding complexity. And that in itself perhaps allows for more expansive ideas or around adolescence to be sort of put out into early modern culture. And another thing that does seem to shift is how adolescence, particularly in the later plays from Shakespeare, how adolescence is framed in terms of their relationship to love plots. A lot of the earlier plays that focus on adolescence tend to have love plots really at the centre, and it's particularly in the comedies that you see this happening. But in later plays, we often have adolescents explored through their relationships to their parents. So Miranda with Prospero, to take a particularly late play, like The Tempest, is setting things up. It still has a love plot in there, but it's much less significant and less central than this idea of how is Miranda understood in relation to her role on the island, to her father, and also to Caliban. In that play. So you get kind of more expansive things going on by resituating the plot for the adolescent. And one of the reasons for that I suggest in the book is that it could be because of how the actual company of Shakespeare is aging. So Richard Burbage, I've talked about playing Orlando, he before that had sort of started to specialise in adolescent characters. So he would have performed as Romeo in the mid-1590s, and he probably initially played the role of Lysander, who is an adolescent male in Midsummer Night's Dream, and then went on to the late 1590s. So 1599 is the date we often use for As You Like It, and he's Orlando. But that seems to be almost where there seems to be a bit of a crux and a turning point. He's certainly shifting to more senior roles by around 1605, Some scholars suggest he starts to take on the role of Oberon, so the fairy king in Midsummer Night's Dream. He's also then looking to roles like Macbeth, which, you know, King Lear, and much later Prospero. So he seems to be that his own aging, by which point he's, you know, well into his 30s, he seems to no longer be playing the younger adolescent role. So there seems to be material circumstances as well that lead to these shifts, but they have implications for how we are asked to understand and engage with representation of adolescence. And I think probably one of the most interesting things for me is that once you have a sort of displacing of that love plot idea, particularly for girl characters, is that you kind of see less of that limiting in relation to those reproductive futures. You have more chance to explore some of those cognitive abilities of girls and their heated brains. So that starts to sort of be something that you can see going on across by thinking about the career of Shakespeare and the changes in what adolescents are doing in the plays.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting kind of development to understand. So thank you for mapping that out for us. As we kind of come to the end of the book, I've obviously mentioned a few things that I found surprising or that I learnt from reading this, but obviously you're so much closer to it. So I wonder if there's anything in the research or writing of this that surprised you as you came across it.
One of the things that was surprising, it's partly based on conversations I had with colleagues when I was talking about what I was working on, and that's the lack of spots on early modern adolescence. And I'm sure it wasn't literally a lack of spots. I'm sure that there were spotty adolescents, no doubt. But it's quite surprising that talking to individuals today, assumptions and sort of ideas of signs of puberty is that spots gets mentioned, but spots aren't really often used as signs of puberty in early modern literature, except for there is a really great quote where a writer called William Vaughan gets quite excitable and quite graphic in a depiction of spots, but it was really the only one I could find. And in conversations with colleagues then, it did mean that I sort of found that quite surprising. And that it could be the case that everyone was more spotty, maybe, in early modern culture, or that it's associated with more readily with other stages of the life cycle. So I do know that Hannah Newton's work on earlier childhood highlights that spot-related illnesses were particularly common in earlier childhood. So it might be that spots on adolescents' faces were just not so, you know, interesting or not so worrying, and so didn't sort of get the attention. And certainly in representations of adolescence in Shakespeare, they're spot-free, because it seems in early modern theatre, and particularly if they're artificially constructed through makeup, it seems that spots and blemishes are associated with other things, like signs of disease and sin, and aligned with ideas of physiognomy rather than being age-specific. So I guess then it's really the spotless sort of image of adolescence that was perpetuated through Shakespeare's plays, that I was a bit surprised that I didn't also find behind that more spots in the medical literature as well.
I think that just speaks to kind of how much our ideas about what the different stages look like are so kind of time and place specific, are so culturally specific, because that does seem surprising given how we talk about it today. And yet, as you said, not in Shakespeare, not in the discourses at the time. So thank you for highlighting that. I do have a final question, which always does seem a bit strange when the book has kind of just come out. But obviously, for it to be available in the world, obviously, you had to finish it a while back because of how publishing works. So now that it's off your plate, is there anything you might be looking to work on next, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this exact topic, that you'd like to preview or highlight?
Yes, I mean, you're right. So having written the book a while ago, I'm now dealing with my unfinished business, if you like, in that what I noticed in writing the book but didn't quite have the space to fully sort of delve into. So the book, you know, as we've been saying, is about sort of understanding what the cultural signs of puberty were and how that might look in Shakespeare's plays. But something that sort of emerges in the latter chapters is quite insistent and persistent figure of the child actor as a subject who's collaborating in putting on plays. And I'm not quite done with that idea of these collaborating child actors, and particularly in relation to plays that have content that seem to have really quite important implications for young people. So I'm currently writing an article about Titus Andronicus, which actually I only mentioned quite briefly in the book. But Titus Andronicus is Shakespeare's most violent play. And much of that violence is inscribed upon the bodies of children. And much of the political oppositions and tensions are played out through adults at least instigating, if not actually always physically doing the harm, that these bodies of children are mutilated, there's murder. It's in many ways, it's a horrific play because of the harms done to children in it. And so something though that I want to really think through, and I'm thinking through in an article at the moment, is that in a play like Titus Andronicus, which is in terms of its plot is absolutely geared against children. Children are subject to the authority of adults repeatedly in that play. But the scenes, if you look at the scenes and you look for the adolescent actors, lots of the scenes in Titus Andronicus, and it's some of the key scenes related to the most horrific violence in that play, utterly depend on adolescent actors performing the roles. And there are some scenes where the adults leave the stage and you've just got adolescent actors, you know, performing. And for me, that's really intriguing because on the one hand, it's unsettling because you think you've got these children involved in this representation of harms being done to children. How far are they being exploited in that spectacle? But it's also fascinating because of how I've worked through in the chapters for this book, how acting and producing voice, you know, is a craft, is skilled and involves the efforts of the child actor. I can't quite ignore the collaborative aspect in a play like this. It might see that this is a moment where child actors, adolescents are speaking back to some of the harms done to children, both in early modern culture more widely, but also specifically theatrical culture where children were regularly exploited. So it's quite an unsettling sort of proposition that I'm looking at in terms of this quite, you know, notoriously graphic and violent play. But I do want to think about, yes, where are the adult, the adolescent actors contributing and maybe also challenging and speaking back to the harms that are done to them in the plot of Titus Andronicus, but also more widely in early modern culture. So that's what's keeping me busy at the moment, Miranda.
All right. Well, you said this book came out of an earlier project. Clearly, kind of your next thing is coming out of this, and who knows what will happen after that. So best of luck with that. And of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing titled Shakespeare's Adolescence, Age, Gender and the Body in Shakespearean Performance and Early Modern Culture, just out from Manchester University Press. Vicky, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's been really great. Thank you.